Accession number 19389, Reel 2.
Ron Cashman, Reel 2. How much pain were you in from the wound at this time?
Not a lot, really. It was a fair slab of grenade fragment had buried itself into my left shoulder. Hadn't hit any bones. It was wedged in there in the muscles and between the bones, I think. It took a fair while, really, before I did feel any pain. I think I was almost down to the Indian ambulance before it started to grate on me. So I was in no agony, just inconvenienced.
What kind of medical treatment did you get for this wound?
At the battalion aid post, they sterilised it and covered it with a bandage, I believe, and then I and my two other comrades were whipped back to the Indian field ambulance, where I think they removed the shrapnel and dressed me up. I know I spent the night and some time of the next day there. It's all a bit blurred from here on because we sort of were in the Indian, then we were in the Norwegian, then we were in an American MASH, and finally we finished up flying back to Japan and in the British hospital at Kure. So it's very hard for me. I just can't remember really what took place.
Were you satisfied with the treatment that you got?
Oh, I'm sure I was. I can't remember any reason to complain. No, the Indians were extremely compassionate. They were compassionate to a fault. Only complaint I've got with the Indians is that curry they fed me nearly caused me to have a heart attack. Far too hot for mine. The Norwegians, as I recall, I don't recall any hassles with them. The Americans, very good. The only problem with the Americans is they had the misfortune to be attacked by the guerrillas one night we were there. They had a Negro concert party and they making their rounds entertaining each of the wards. And for the very first time in my life I heard this song, Jambalaya, the coffee's fine, Billy Jumbo, Jambalaya. And I was fascinated with jambalaya. So I followed them to about two or three other wards after mine, listening to them play this jambalaya. When they'd finished their concert, being Negroes, of course, they were segregated, and they had a special section put aside for them in the hospital compound. And they were having a little party and a sing-song there, and the North Korean guerrillas entered the establishment after disposing of the American guards, which wouldn't have been very difficult, I shouldn't imagine. And they came in and they attacked these poor bloody entertainers. Literally massacred them. They just caught them sitting in the open around the fires and grenaded and burp gunned them. And then they dashed around throwing grenades and firing bursts into the wards as you know, willy-nilly as they liked. Meanwhile, the local engineer unit, I think it was busy scrambling a relief force to come and save everybody's bum. By the time they got there, the Koreans had probably run out of ammunition and grenades anyway and disappeared back into the mountains. What the final casualties were, I don't know, but they must have got a fair few. Because there's nobody there to defend the place. They'd polished off the guards and the rest are unarmed medical people and patients. That was very exciting for a while.
Were patients hit?
Oh, I should imagine they would have been. One English bloke got burnt. The Americans very kindly had a space heater in the ward, like a big pot-bellied stove. And they used to keep this rather large Dixie on it. It's probably held about maybe 2 or 3 gallons. And this was constantly full of brewing tea, which probably you could tan a hide with if you wished. And this was there for the use of the Britishers, as they call us in mass, Britishers. And this thing got hit by a bullet, and I remember one of the young Brits had dived out of his bed, wisely, while the shooting was going on, and was on the floor, once again wisely, and this Dixie of almost boiling tea got shot off the stove and cascaded onto him, so he got some serious burns from this boiling tea. What the other casualties were, I can't recall. I don't know all. It was just sheer pandemonium in our own ward. What happened in the other wards? I've no idea. No idea.
What did you see of the attackers yourself?
Next to nothing. My bed was near a window. In fact, I've got a photo of myself sitting up in the bed. Stretcher, not bed. And when the shooting and grenades started in the first place, I think probably all of the infantrymen that were in the ward or wards would have been on the deck anyway. They wouldn't have been waiting around for any written invitations. So the only people that would have been caught unprepared would have been people from rear units like artillery and some that weren't used to hitting the deck. So most of us, myself most certainly, was grovelling on the floor and just saw the grenades exploding and saw the holes appearing in the walls from the burst, but I and most of the others weren't getting up to check anything out. We were staying right where we were, so we didn't see anything.
And where was this hospital that was attacked?
Outside of Weijongbu somewhere. But don't ask me where. It's just another dirt stop on the side of the road to me.
And this would have been in the autumn of 51? November?
Late October, I think. I think, yes, late October.
Do you think they would have known it was a hospital?
Oh, I wouldn't have any doubts, because the guerrillas that used to be around, there were quite a lot around in those days. I'm pretty sure they knew everything that was in their territory. They probably even knew the CO's name and address. They were acquainted with everything that was going on. There was nobody harassing them. They were living in the mountains. They had good cover. They'd make a raid, they'd get food. Oh, they'd have known it was a hospital. They were probably just doing a little terrorising. And it was a soft target, too.
Did you make a full recovery from your wounds?
I went to Curay and had a blissful couple of weeks there. And I thought the English were very civilised. Part of our daily diet, every morning received a small bottle of Guinness Stout as a regular item in the diet, and that taught me to appreciate British culture a lot more from that time. Never realised just how civilised they were. I didn't take standing to attention at the end of the bed every morning when the CO of the hospital, the colonel, ponced his way around the ward. If you could stand, you had to get to your feet. And he made his appearance and disappeared again. All totally unnecessary, but I suppose he got a kick out of it.
So, now, after that, what happened to you?
Back to Korea then. Once again, flew back and rejoined my platoon. This time I acquired... I had a friend... He'd been in 6th platoon with me, masquerading as a private, Peter Sir the Pavey, his name was. He'd been a rear echelon man. I digress here. Do you want me to digress?
Yes, please.
He'd done his first tour as a rear echelon man, and he wasn't at all pleased about that. He wanted to get up the front, but he couldn't. He was a staff sergeant. So he came back for his second tour and masquerading as a private soldier and went to C Company, 6th Platoon B Company. And it took them at least a week to find out where their missing staff sergeant was and hunt him back from 6th Platoon. But at least he'd achieved his moment of fame. He'd been a combat man, and that was what he wanted. So he was in charge of all the... weapons, and when I was coming back through B Echelon, he presented me with a brand spanking new Owen gun, still done up in the greaseproof paper, and its number was 1049. And I was like a child with a brand new toy. I was the owner of an Owen gun. So back I returned to 6th Platoon, and amongst the elite, then with an automatic weapon. And this time, we were just, or B Company, was just being detached from the battalion. And for what reason, I have no idea, because there's not even any mention of it in our battalion history. But they detached B Company across to a very rugged, pine-covered feature, which is now occupied by Observation Post Typhoon in South Korea on the DMZ. Anyway, it was at that time occupied by the 7th Cavalry Regiment of the 1st Cavalry Division, and B Company was put with them. And we had Thanksgiving Day with them, I'm sure, because we got ice cream and turkey. Anyway, the position we were in was a type of a mountain ridge, and on the northern slope it ran down, flattened off, and came to the Imjin River. Now the Imjin River in this spot, which was much to the east of 355, it did a sharp 90 degree turn. It more or less ran west to east, and then did an abrupt turn to the north. Now, the Americans were fighting on the eastern side of the bank. They were trying to take some features there and having the utmost difficulty. On the western side, where this 90 degree turn was, there was a low ridge line, more or less in no man's land. It was a huge valley that ran out from the east of 317, 355 and the Hinge, and it was a massive great valley. And this feature had three knolls, the first one being the higher one, middle one, middle size, and the rear one nearest the bend in the river had a graveyard. Korean graveyard on it. As you probably know, the Koreans in the old days used to bury their bodies in mounds. The body would be sitting in the ground and a raised mound over the top. And no good my waving my arms, because that won't come out in the tape. Anyway, this graveyard area had had been mined by somebody. In those days, anybody would mine anything at the drop of a hat. So it was mined and fenced. Before we had our little excitement over there, they sent six platoon, or half of us, out to do the patrol across the river, and there was a ford across the river near the bend in it. It was about thigh deep. And on the bluff overlooking it, the Americans had a fairly large outpost with a 50 caliber machine gun. And they sent half a 6th platoon across the river to do a patrol up this valley. I, being a bit older in the head by this stage, took my boots off so that I'd be able to patrol in dry boots. When we got across the river, put the boots on, and we're chuffing up the valley there very serenely, and Charlie put in an almighty attack. He was bouncing the Cosbys all over the place, and they were starting to get a bit obnoxious in our little area, so we picked up our skirts and fled back to the river. And as we approached the banks of the river, quite a few of us were wearing slouch hats, and it wasn't a really dark night. We were yelling and cooing to the Americans across the other side of the river and trying to impress upon them the fact that we weren't Chinese, we were Australians who had just left them. And foolishly we rushed into the river, and as we started to make our way across, the Americans, whom we'd only just said goodbye to, proceeded to hammer the hell out of us with their 50 caliber machine gun and whatever else they could open up with. Now, this caused no end of excitement amongst us. Most of us, being pretty proficient swimmers, just dived into the water and went downstream and crossed the river further downstream unopposed, and then returned abusing the Americans in no uncertain manner. And by the grace of God, they never hit one of us. That's probably why they had such a bad time stopping the Chinese. From point blank range, they have not hit one of us, but they've terrorized us. So that was all right. Well, then, after this, they decided that they needed a platoon across the river permanently, and they, in their wisdom, somebody decided that the central feature, central knoll on this three-knoll feature, would be the place to go. There were already positions dug there by Lord knows who and when. So they sent 6th platoon across there. And we had trenches, which we patched up. We had foxholes, which we enlarged. We had fighting pits. We had quite a secure little position. We had no wire to speak of. There was a bit of barbed wire around. Nothing much, though. And directly across the river from us, to our east, or as we faced north, to our right-hand side, a bit hard to visualise, the Americans were changing ownership of this particular hill or hills on almost a daily basis. And I think, looking back, I think the Yanks wanted us on this hill as A, an outpost, and B, an early warning if they were going to be attacked from the flank. If anyone was to attack them from the flank, they'd have to go through us first, which, being a platoon, would have been no problem. But we used to be on a regular one-hourly contact with the Americans on our radio. If we missed an hourly contact, there'd be panic. So the Americans used to take this hill almost every morning. Their tactics were pathetic, to say the least, but that was because of the officers leading them. The American, they call themselves dog faces, GIs, their courage was unquestionable, because they would line up in a line of 100 men or so across the base of this hill, and they would proceed up the hill, shooting from the hip, being shot back up at, shot down at, grenades, mortars, whatever, and as fast as they fell, there'd be a fresh group take their place, and they'd take the hill. The most suicidal tactic you could wish. I mean, any sane Brit or Australian would have refused to entertain the idea of doing this sort of thing. But the Yanks did it. They get criticised a lot, but the courage of those men was beyond question. The intelligence of their officers left a lot to be desired. So they'd take this hill, and they'd bolster it up with goodness knows how many men and how much equipment and everything. There was a road ran right to the base of it from the big hill that the 7th Cab, who were replaced by the 3rd Infantry Division. But there was a road, supply road, ran right up to the base of this hill, so they're able to bring trucks up and bolster up their numbers on the hill, and then that night the Chinese would attack and take the damn thing back again. We used to sit there and watch this every day. After we'd been there a few days, Chinese used to set up a mortar on, all right, if you're looking south to north along our ridge line, we're in the middle one. They used to set up a mortar detachment. I don't know how many mortars they had. Might have been two, might have been four, but they were the big ones, equivalent to the big Brit mortars. 4.2, I think they were. But they were the big ones the Chinese had. And they used to plaster the Yanks across the river safely from the base of our little feature, knowing that nobody could retaliate with artillery because they'd clobber us, you see. We were their shield. Then they came up with an even more brilliant piece of manoeuvring. They brought this self-propelled gun from somewhere just after dusk in the evening. This thing had come trundling out of nowhere. They must have been in a cave, goodness knows, anyway. It would have come along and it would get up to the base on the left-hand side of our position, and they'd pump a couple of rounds up to us just probably to say good evening and spend the rest of the night hammering the Yanks across the river once again with us as a perfect shield. Nobody could retaliate because they'd splatter us. Oh, anyway, this was going on day after day, and they were probing us with small 10 or 20 man probes, but they weren't making any serious effort to push us off the feature. It was the start of winter, the first frosts and everything were coming, and very cold. Anyway, we weren't getting any sleep. I went to sleep for the very first time in my life standing on my feet there in a fighting pit one evening. I actually went to sleep on my feet. We were that tired. One morning, my little part of the country was at sort of the rear of our feature, on the saddle between us and the mound with the graveyard on it. I'd set a couple of mines as booby traps down there the night before, and I wasn't smart enough, because the next morning I went to check on them and the trips wires had been cut. So my booby trapping was to no avail. But anyway, this particular morning I happened to, we'd had a clash during the night. They'd made a minor probe and we'd retaliated, and my mate with the Bren gun was quite sure he'd got someone. And I saw the tracks leading back from the frost, through the frost. The frost was quite heavy, almost like snow. The tracks came up where they'd had their little scuffle with us, and then their tracks led down again. So I, in my wisdom, decided I'd follow these tracks. I used to get rushes of blood to the head like this now and then. And I followed these tracks back down to the bottom of the feature and across to where the graveyard was. I followed the tracks and I came across a homemade stretcher made out of two barbed wire pickets and a couple of old ponchos that they've got hold of and some cardboard cartons, and they'd fashioned a stretcher out of this, and it was covered in fresh blood, and there was also a Chinese winter jacket there with three bullet holes right in the navel area and all heavily bloodstained. So that was obviously the fellow my mate claimed during the night. And I followed the tracks up to the minefield fence at the graveyard on the top of this knoll. I might add, nobody knew I was out. Six platoon, the boss and that had no idea. I'd just gone for a more early morning walk. And I saw the tracks heading off into the minefield and disappearing amongst the mounds. And then I could see these jumping jack mines sticking up here, there, and the Chinese had removed some of them, dug them out of the ground, and they had them sitting just beside the track. They had a well-worn regular track going in there. And this obviously was where their mortar team were coming out from every night. They were in that graveyard and coming out of a night time and hammering their yanks and retiring the security of their bunkers or not. But at that stage, I knew absolutely nothing whatsoever about mines. The initial training in the Australian Army basically told you, if you see a mine, don't stand on it. And that was about it. So I knew, in fact, the only thing I ever learned about mines, I learned the hard way as I went along. So I saw these jumping jack mines and I decided, well, I better not go in there because I might blow myself up. I went back down to the bottom of the hill, and I should have taken the jacket back for a souvenir, but I didn't. Went back to the platoon position, and nobody even knew I'd gone. They never had a clue, because everyone was sort of in a state of semi-consciousness all the time through the lack of sleep then, and we were just catnapping whenever we got the chance. So nobody even knew I'd gone. I told my mate that he'd definitely got his kill. I'd found the jacket. And then we suddenly discovered that the main knoll in front, we were the ham and the sandwich, as it turned out. Their infantry was pretty heavily dug in, and they may have even had that SP gun in the big main feature, with the mortar people at the back and us in the middle, in the centre knoll. We discovered that that was where they had a considerable force dug in there, and they were harassing us from there fairly often. And then they started sniping. They got one of our blokes sitting on the edge of his trench one morning, and they got him. And the Americans must have decided that they were going to teach these fellows a lesson. How they knew they were there, I don't know. But anyway, they called in an airstrike on it. And these American fighter bombers were circling around. And we were all, pardon me, I suppose in a direct rifle shot from the top